Hello, WGN listening audience.
Live from the biggest small town in America, it's the Saturday Night Special with Amy Goode.
WGN. So this week, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb signed a pretty controversial gaming bill legalizing mobile sports wagering just days after Iowa and Montana passed similar bills. This almost exactly a year after the Supreme Court ruling that federal law that banned states from legalizing sports betting was unconstitutional, and therefore states could make their own decisions on the matter. According to the American Gaming Association, gaming in general in the U.S. is a $240 billion, with a B, dollar industry, employing 1.7 million people in 40 states. In 2016, gaming taxes contributed nearly $9 billion in state and local tax revenues. Illegal gambling, sports betting in particular, is estimated to be approximately $150 billion industry. Now, some economists argue that that number is just far too high. After all, that would be about 14 times more than Americans spend going to the movies, and about twice as much as they put into grooming and feeding their pets. But illegal markets are hard to measure. In any case, it's a lot. And on the heels of the Supreme Court ruling, states are starting to open up the debate on sports betting and recognizing that the technology that powers the gaming industry has evolved and more modern laws are needed. Although we're talking about it a lot right now, given its evolving legal status, it, of course, is not new. British colonies, in fact, used lotteries to raise money. And interestingly enough, a 1769 restriction by the British Crown was one of the issues that fueled tensions leading to the Revolutionary War. During Prohibition, towns that already had tax positions about various vices became major gambling centers, thus upping tourism. The Great Depression saw legalized gambling in some light forms, like bingo and so forth, mostly to allow civic groups to raise money. In Nevada, a combination of the stock market crash of 1929, coupled with the cost of building the Hoover Dam, brought about the legalization of gambling in most forms to provide a source of revenue for the state. And well, by now we all know that what happens in Vegas indeed stays there. An Oxford Economics study indicated that legalizing sports gambling would contribute about $23 billion to the U.S. GDP. And not surprisingly, everybody wants their cut. Casino owners, government, sports leagues, tech companies. And how that money gets split up impacts all of us as consumers, if so inclined to put our money down on sports. So tonight, we'll explore the topic of legalized gambling, sports betting in particular. We'll hear from a history professor about the evolution of gambling in the U.S. to give us some context. We'll talk with an Indiana state representative to look for the legislative work that led up to last week, a sports journalist who covers the industry of sports betting, and with an entrepreneur who's looking to challenge the economic framework with which we think about gambling. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special. We'll be right back to get the conversation underway on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special, and as ever, we take one big topic and we spend the whole night talking about it in different ways with different people. And tonight, that topic is gambling. In particular, we're going to be kind of focusing on sports wagering, because that's been up with our neighbors in Indiana and our neighbors in Iowa. Both of those things got both of those states legalized sports gambling this past week, and many other states are having these conversations about sports wagering, because on Tuesday, it's a year anniversary since the Supreme Court ruling around that topic, letting states decide for themselves. So we're going to be taking a look at that tonight. In a little bit, on the other side of the 7:30 news, we're going to be talking with Indiana State Representative Terry Austin, who worked on that legislation in Indiana, and kind of get a behind the scenes look of what that was like, and some issues and building consensus and all of that. And then a little bit later in the show, in the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to talk with Adam Candy, who's managing editor of Legal Sports Report and a host on ESPN Las Vegas, kind of taking a look at what that would mean to sports journalism. I think that's a really interesting topic. Not only has Adam been covering this topic for quite a while and very much in depth at Legal Sports Report and some other outlets, here the idea of if most states or all states were to suddenly legalize sports gambling, what would that do to sports journalism? Would it do anything? I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. You know, for example, Fox announced this week that it's going to partner with a bet taker called BetStars. So lots of issues like that, lots of considerations. And then we're going to close the show talking with Matthew Curtis, who is the founder of a company called Vice Lotteries, which is really interesting. I always like to put somebody in that last spot of the show that's doing something really future facing or really outside of the box. And this is certainly someone who qualifies. And he's really trying to change the literal game of gambling. So we're going to be talking with him a little bit later. But right now on the program, we are joined by Kevin Kaufman, who holds a PhD from Loyola University in American history. And he's we've had him on the show before. Longtime listeners will know and remember him. Dr. K, hello. Welcome back to the program.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Absolutely.
So this is an interesting topic, right? I think as I started to research the history of gambling in the U.S., especially sports wagering, it got really interesting because it seems like major moments in American history, this is threaded through it. This was not like a standalone thing that popped up in isolation. We've had this for quite a while here, and it's kind of been in the room for a lot of big moments in history.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we've gambled quite a bit. Sports gambling, card games, dice, for a really long time, if it was illegal, it wasn't enforced, and a lot of times it wasn't even illegal. It was kind of that look the other way kind of atmosphere for a lot of it, unless it was, completely okay. So
I think go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we like to bet.
We do. We like to bet because I think it has the promise of, it appeals to a lot of things, right? It appeals to, I was right. It appeals to, I gained a little money. And I think especially if you're struggling with money, that's a very shiny, wonderful promise. It's about fortune and chance and is lady luck on my side or the odds in my favor. It really speaks to a lot of things about hope that I think are really interesting. One detail that I read about, and there wasn't a ton out there, but you probably know 50 books on the topic. You being you. But I was reading about how a restriction in 1769 by the British Crown started fueling, was one of the issues fueling tensions leading up to the Revolutionary War. So that was, colonists brought it with them and were doing all kind of gambling and using lotteries to raise money and whatnot. And then here it is in the room as we step into Revolutionary War time.
Yeah, actually, I didn't know that one.
But, I'm here to
help.
That
doesn't surprise me.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think we think of it like mostly with a Chicago connection, like during Prohibition. We think about like the speakeasy, the back room, the bathtub gin, and it was just kind of like a time of secret vice. So it seems to me that as we're entering this time of states having conversations about legalizing different forms of gambling. And I think this sits alongside conversations about legalizing marijuana in various ways. It's really about revisiting a taboo maybe that we've had since, for years and years in this country.
Oh, for sure. I think it's one of the things that it's almost like a cycle of, the 1880s, 90s, 1910s, all of these things become illegal. All of these, like you said, vices that we had become enemy number one, and it's all tied into gambling and drinking and the criminalization of marijuana and how all that comes about, that all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but like you said, then we get to Prohibition, and yet we all want to kind of sneak our way around it and find the back room and find the seedy places, as some might say. But and I think we're kind of swinging back to, maybe it's okay to let people have their their vices a little bit.
Right. It is interesting, though, you know, as you list off the vices, we tend to, you know, have a major taboo or a major hang up about things of, oh, that who could ever do X, Y, Z. And then as the needle moves on attitudes with those, it's like, okay, I'll move from being the moral police to I'll just tax this thing. And that becomes like a more socially acceptable way to still cast aspersions on that vice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The great syntax that
right.
we always seem to throw out there. But I think as long as we keep it, especially the things that we keep promoting that are actually bad for you, like smoking, the syntax eventually isn't going to work because, well, we actually want you to quit smoking. But I think with gambling, it's probably a little bit safer for the state. And I think that's, too, where the taboo starts to kind of get shifted in that, you know, thinking back to that time of like the 1910s and stuff when a lot of gambling is really being cracked down on. It's very interesting that, for instance, horse racing is never illegal. And wagering at the track is never illegal because that's, you know, that's kind of, you know, the people who raise horses and frequent those places tend to be, you know, pretty wealthy, middle class. Same thing with country clubs and all the betting that goes on there. That never was ever going to be regulated. But anything that was done kind of in the streets, in the tenderloin districts, that was really where things had to go. So, you know, now that racetracks and such things are really hurting for money, it's not a big shock that states are kind of thinking, well, how else can we make money?
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting, right? Because then it becomes about, it's only wrong if it's about, it becomes very classist, and it's only wrong if poor, mm-hmm. you know, poor people are doing it, and then it's horrible. But if it's done gentlemanly, like if it's over a friendly game of golf or horse racing or a card game at a country club, it's perfectly okay because we're gentlemen, which is, I think, a thing we've seen again and again, not just, you know, outside of gambling. We've seen it again and again in history.
Right.
But I mean, to me, that points to, we've always kind of, in a sense, I guess, used it like, well, okay, but we can make money on it. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, making of Las Vegas, right? Here's this moment mm-hmm. where the crash of 1929, still reeling from that, and then the cost of building the Hoover Dam is really hitting the state, and suddenly it's like, well, okay, maybe we could do some gambling, raise some revenue, and it's a hit. Right. And suddenly the perfect storm of, you know, investors and high profile people get involved and it becomes this perfect thing. So to me, you know, and then we see it like again, we also see it in like in the Great Depression when it's like, okay, bingo's okay to raise money, but as long as it's for a good cause. So it seems like this weird, this push pull kind of negotiation mm-hmm. with throughout American history of like, well, it's okay if we need it, but otherwise it's bad.
Right. Yeah, and that's a great example, too, of, like, the daily numbers and things like that. That, you know, for years and years, that was very illegal, you know, racketeering and all the different ways that they would come up with how to, you know, determine the daily number. And then when the state gets involved, of course, it's, well, that's perfectly okay. You know, it's not nearly as bad if Springfield or whichever state capital is capitalizing on it. And I think it would be such a shock now, I think, to somebody, say, from 1915, if you could play your numbers on a Sunday. I think they would absolutely just be blown away that we do such things.
That's an interesting point, right? Last time you were on the show was when we were talking about a lot about prohibition and how some mm-hmm. blue laws still exist, like buying alcohol on a Sunday
right.
in some places. And I think that's really interesting. Now, however, I think if someone from 1915 came in, the first thing they'd have to get their head around would be Twitter. They'd be like, what's that?
Oh, yeah.
It's like telegrams, but weird and mean. I don't know.
Right, and in your pocket. So, yeah, just don't.
It's a telegram machine. There'd be a lot of shocks. I think gambling would be but one of them. Well, as ever,
yeah.
I appreciate you for giving some context to this topic. Always appreciate you. I wish we had hours and hours to talk more in depth with you about it, but thank you so much for joining the program. Always appreciate you, Kevin Kaufman.
My pleasure. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. So a little bit earlier today, I spoke with Indiana State Representative Terry Austin about the legislative work leading up to last week when, on Wednesday, the Indiana governor signed into law that to legalize sports gambling. So a little bit earlier, I talked to her. Here is what she said. So this controversial gaming bill was signed into law in Indiana this week, legalizing mobile sports betting and allowing for a new casino in the state. So if you would describe for us the process. I know there were initially a couple versions of this bill, Indiana Senate Bill 552. Talk us through that process of that bill and the debate around it there.
Well, the bill was actually a comprehensive gaming bill was introduced in the Senate and by Senator Mark Messmer, who's a former House member, Senate Bill 552. And Mark actually spent the summer meeting with various gaming interest groups, you know, folks who work on behalf of casinos, racinos, the riverboats, and sports betting, and tried to put together what he thought was a comprehensive bill that addressed all of the gaming issues in the state of Indiana that needed to have some decisions made or at least some debate. The bill came out of the Senate Public Policy Committee, went to the Senate Leave Tax and Fiscal Policy, and then ultimately came out third reading in the Senate, and it was a significant vote. I mean, it was an overwhelming vote. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but you can certainly look those up. And then it comes over, it starts all over again in the House. It was assigned to public policy, of which I am a member, and the chairman spent several weeks actually looking at the bill, contemplating some changes, and then in committee introduced a chairman's amendment, which made some dramatic changes to the bill. Understanding that gaming bills are always a work in progress, it was important, at least the overwhelming majority of the committee members felt it was important to keep the bill moving because they knew it was going to continue to undergo additional changes. It went from public policy to the House Ways and Means Committee, came out and went through some additional changes in Ways and Means, came out on the floor, and again, had a fairly overwhelming vote. I want to say it was 79 to 20. And then at that point, you've got two different versions of the bill. So it goes to conference committee. I was one of the House sponsors of the bill, and so was the Democrat on the conference committee, and the House Democrat, and then there was a Senate Democrat, and then a Senate and House Republicans both. So, you know, at that point, the conferees start discussing the bill. I met with advisors to see what their primary goals for the legislation would be. And in the end, there was a series of give and take, and we got out on a Wednesday. On Monday, there was a conference committee report that was produced primarily by House Republicans. And at that point, over the weekend, what had happened is our Constitution requires that any tax and revenue bill has to start in the House. So since this bill had actually started in the Senate, they needed to take the contents, put it into a House bill, and they moved all the advisors, all the conferees over, and it basically became House Bill 1015. A conference committee had been introduced, but there was not a lot of interest by at least three of the parties in signing it at that point, because we were working on some other provisions that we felt had been in the bill on the Senate side that we wanted to have in the bill on the House side. So some negotiations took place, some conversations among the conferees, and then ultimately we were able to get first three signatures on the language, and then the fourth came along and, you know, we voted the bill out, and that's what happened.
You know, it seemed in watching this unfold in Indiana, it certainly seemed like context for mobile use was such a sticking point and really took a lot of nuanced thinking and language around that. What was the process and the main narrative, I guess, for overcoming that and reaching a consensus with that?
Well, I think it's just recognizing that the technology behind gaming changes every day. And, you know, one of the things we wanted to have was some integrity around the age of folks who sign up for mobile sports betting, trying to create a regulatory framework that had a chance at success. That there already were some, so what I call some regulatory infrastructure in place, and that's why we included in the bill the requirement that the gaming, the sports wagering could take place at riverboats, racinos, the new Vigo County Casino, if they choose to pass one through a referendum, and then satellite facilities, OTBs. Those folks already have a regulatory framework, process, and integrity in place. And so folks have to go sign up there. You have to show your proof of age. And then there'll be mobile apps available for people to take advantage of that after they've established an account. It's the establishment of the initial account that we think is so important. But if you said that you could only conduct sports betting at any of these facilities that I just named, we've got large areas of our state that don't have access to those. And so that, to me, begs the question, well, are you really going to draw people into the legal framework then? Or is we going to continue to have illegal sports betting, which we know goes on and in Indiana is estimated to be a $300 million a year industry? So the mobile piece of it, I think, is twofold. It recognizes that access to, you know, folks who want to engage in this, they're going to have to set up an account first. After that, you don't necessarily want to preclude them because it's not right, and I think it could be subject to a legal challenge at some point. And then the second thing is to make sure that you want them to enter into the legal enterprise and not be swept up in the illegal enterprise.
And you know, as you're saying this, I'm thinking of this so closely mirrors what we see in other sectors of business, right? Where we say, okay, the retailers, the brick and mortar retailers are having to shift as behavior is more about shopping online and it's about convenience. And I wonder, this might be too much of an oversimplification, but on some level, it does seem like modernizing a law to keep up with technology and how people, you know, convenience is going to usually win out.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, that's exactly the example I thought about earlier today. I was thinking about our conversation. And I mean, that's exactly what's happened. You know, brick and mortar retail, grocery shopping. I mean, think of all the things that you do now. I can even sit and order my groceries in the convenience of my own home, have a cup of coffee in the morning, schedule the time I'm going to pick them up, and drive to the store, they're ready to go. Or if I'm lucky enough to live in a larger metropolitan area, I can even have them delivered to my house. Even television, you know, or how you watch mobile entertainment. And that's what I think folks have to remember. Yes, gaming is a regulated enterprise, but it's also entertainment for people. And you want people to be responsible about it. You want them to be legal about it. But entertainment has changed dramatically.
That is a conversation I had a little bit earlier today with Indiana State Representative Terry Austin. We're going to take a little break, finish that conversation here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Before the break, I was speaking with Indiana State Representative Terry Austin. We were playing a conversation we had earlier today. We're talking about legalizing sports betting in Indiana. So let's hear part two of that conversation. When debate first arose around this topic in Indiana, were there some misconceptions floating around or people that were maybe trying to oversimplify but glossing over details or something like that?
I don't think so. I think it's just the speed with which you know, we had to get into sports betting. You know, when the Supreme Court ruled that PAPSA was no longer, you know, was unconstitutional, states were basically out there and all of a sudden had to decide, okay, we know this is coming. We know we need to make a decision about whether we're going to be a player or not. There were several conferences and study committees over the summer. So I think folks, you know, folks were trying, on top of the regular gaming issues that arose and needed to be, you know, discussed and debated and decided upon. And so sports betting was certainly one of the more complex issues that was thrown into the mix. But the other thing I think is really important, and if Illinois takes away anything from the Indiana experience, I would encourage them to vest much of the regulatory decision-making and rulemaking with their gaming commission. We have an outstanding gaming commission in Indiana, and they have a lot of integrity. There's never been a problem. In fact, our gaming commissioner, our gaming executive director, Sarah Gonzo-Tate, was named the National Gaming Commissioner of the Year, National Regulator of the Year. And they are the ones who I think have the capacity to perform the due diligence to make sure that there is integrity in the sports betting enterprise, to decide if at the collegiate level which sports you're going to allow betting on, to decide the things like what they call league data, if you're going to, you know, when professional sports are involved, for what they call in-play. And in-play is what happens from the beginning of the start of an event till the end of the start of the event. And so that's what we did. We set some parameters, but basically gave the gaming commission the authority to establish not only the rules, but to decide whether or not you could. I mean, we basically said no sports betting on intramural, no sports betting on high school sports. There's some discussion of only allowing it to take place with Division I sports, and then only maybe three or four of the Division I sports. So again, that's where you have to trust that the gaming commission is going to only approve what they feel they have the capacity to regulate.
So in your mind, what will the biggest benefits be to Indiana for legalizing sports betting?
Well, it's one more amenity that will take place at our established gaming facilities. We're not anticipating that it's going to be a huge moneymaker for the state because so many other states are going to enter into this field. But we also think that, I mean, there will be some revenue for the state, but more importantly, and this is why we also included in this gaming legislation, we moved up the ability to have live dealers, table games at our two racinos who up until January 1st of next year were only allowed to have electronic gambling machines, slots, video simulations, things like that. It's to say, if we're going to have gaming in Indiana, we're trying to create everybody on a level playing field where they have similar amenities and can provide patrons with a complement of experiences. The other thing I think is to give us a chance to actually see how sports wagering actually plays out in our state. I trust that the Gaming Commission will go slowly on, you know, as we introduce this, and it starts July 1st, I believe. So, you know, we've heard from William Hill and some of the others, and that's what I think most of the gaming facilities will utilize, a sports book, quite honestly. And then interestingly enough, we also heard from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway folks, the Pacers folks. I didn't hear so much from the Colts people, but you know, everybody's concerned that they want to have a reliable gaming experience, but they also want it to have protections for players, athletes, and patrons.
Are there any preemptive measures being done on fear that maybe anything about gambling addiction or anything like that. I know that's been kind of a big talking point of the opposition to sports gambling when, you know, I think the truth of the matter is really it's happening, whether it's legal or not, and someone's going to get addicted to gambling, whether they're doing it legally or not. Is there any kind of formal process being done to help make any kind of gambling addiction help a little more accessible to people in the state as this rolls out?
Sure. Our sports wagering tax is 9.5% on the adjusted gross receipts, and 3.3% of that tax revenue has to be deposited in the Addiction Services Fund. We made some changes to how the money in the Addiction Services Fund can be spent. It can also be spent on certification of folks who treat addiction. We did it for outreach. We changed the definition of how it could be spent for outreach, for education, for awareness, and then also making sure that treatment facilities are available or treatment systems are available.
That's a conversation I had a little bit earlier today with Indiana State Representative Terry Austin, giving us a kind of a behind the scenes look at that process as sports gambling became legalized just this past week in Indiana. Right now we're going to take a little break, get you news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us this evening. As ever, we take one big topic and start unpacking it and looking at it from a lot of different angles. And tonight that topic is gambling, in particular sports betting, because that is a topic on a lot of people's minds right now, especially on the state level as we come up on the year anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling saying, hey, states, you can do whatever you want. It's up to you. So who better to talk with about this topic than someone who has covered this very thing extensively. We're joined now by Adam Candy, who is managing editor at Legal Sports Report and a host on ESPN Las Vegas. Adam, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us today. Oh, we're having some technical issues with Adam, so we're just going to give that 1 second for him. And a little bit later, we're going to also be talking with Matthew Curtis, who's a founder at Vice Lotteries, which is a company that's literally trying to just totally change the game. So stick around after the 8:30 news. We'll talk with him. I think we got our technical issues worked out with Adam now, so let's check in with him. Hi, Adam. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
There you are. We got our technical stuff worked out. Very good. Well, I can think of no publication that has covered this topic more than yours, and that is Legal Sports Report. Really a lot of stuff there. And in particular, you've talked to a lot of lawmakers in Illinois. So let's start right there. I think you have a very, probably a better perspective on everything that's happening in Illinois with regard to this topic than anyone. So kind of set the stage for us of where we're at right now and where the breakdowns are happening.
No problem. Well, we're coming up on 1 year since the repeal of PASPA, the federal ban on single game sports wagering. And the removal of that ban, of course, made it possible for states to choose whether or not they would like to legalize sports betting. Illinois has sports betting mixed in with a number of other casino-related issues, and it's a very complicated landscape. We're talking about bills that go back a number of years that we're still trying to work from the pieces of, work from those bones, and add sports betting now into them. So most recently, we've seen 5 different proposals for how to operate sports betting in Illinois. That's what we began with just about a week ago. We saw Representative Mike Zalewski narrowed that to 2. Two proposals that have a number of different angles to them. And right now, the breakdown is trying to figure out, does Illinois want to achieve in terms of tax rate and licensing? Where do they want to set those fees? Where can they encourage the operators like DraftKings, FanDuel, some of the larger companies involved in this, to come into Illinois and operate while at the same time still making sports betting a profitable enterprise for the state? So Governor Pritzker initially suggested a $10 million licensing fee and a tax rate around 20%. We've now seen that fee in some cases, it's a bit complicated, but up closer to 15 to 20 million. That would be the highest licensing fee in the nation if it were to go through, tax rate between 20-25%. So as those go up, of course, the potential profit for the state goes up, but you get some pushback from the operators who would be coming in to put sports betting in place in Illinois, because they, despite the market size of Chicago and beyond, would be then in a less profitable situation for themselves.
You know, I'm glad that you mentioned FanDuel. I wanted to bring that up because just this past week, we heard the CEO of the company say, hey, if you can pass this in Illinois, we're happy to put, you know, put an office in Chicago, and that's going to bring 300 jobs in and make this Midwest hub. So to me, this kind of points to, oh, look, it's politics as usual, and this is as mired in political issues as any topic.
I would agree. If you look at the lobbying force that FanDuel and DraftKings have employed in other states, I mean, it's up over a dozen in some states in terms of the lobbying power that they've put into this. So that much is definitely politics as usual. And what you said with FanDuel offering to put an office in Chicago, I think that's the usual sort of horse trading that we see at the political level. You know, for FanDuel, the cost of putting an office in Chicago would be certainly minimal when compared to the profit that they see in potential from a state as populous as Illinois.
Yeah, and so because Legal Sports Report has been kind of on this from the start and reporting so much about this across the country, state by state, where does it seem like, how's it going to look at the end of 2019? It seems like a lot of states are going, okay, we got to figure this out. Clock's ticking on us. We saw Iowa, Illinois, and Montana this past week. A lot of other conversations are happening. Who seems like, the most likely candidate to go in the second half of the year?
Well, my crystal ball at the beginning of the year was a bit murky, and I don't know that I could have predicted that Montana would be the first state to legalize sports betting in 2019, but there it was up in Big Sky Country. Montana went first, Indiana right behind. We are anticipating that Tennessee will go into law without the governor's signature in the coming weeks, so that'll put us up to three. Governor Reynolds in Iowa has up to 30 days, which I think we're down to about, if I'm not mistaken, 20 in that period now to make a decision on the sports betting law there. So we could be looking at four coming in. The state of Arkansas is going to start sometime around Memorial Day. They legalized sports betting in the election in 2018. So you began this year with eight states having some sort of legal sports betting operation. You'll probably look at four more coming in fairly soon. Now, when we start to look at the second half of 2019, as you mentioned, Illinois is obviously in the discussion. If you were to make me, not to be too cliche to what we're talking about, but to place a wager, I would probably bet against Illinois at this point, not heavily. I think it's less than 50-50. I would look to Michigan. Michigan actually passed the sports betting law at the end of its legislative session last year. That was vetoed by outgoing Governor Snyder. There's still momentum in the legislature to pass sports betting for Michigan, so I would look at Michigan. New York is a quagmire of politics and questions in terms of what they're ultimately going to do, but New York is still within the discussion right now. So those are the states that I would keep an eye on as we head into the second half of 2019.
Indeed. We're talking with Adam Candy, managing editor of Legal Sports Report. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, if you can stick with us, Adam, I have some other questions for you, particularly about how this might shift the way we do. I'm going to put you on hold. Sounds like you got a truck going by you, but particularly around the way that this might impact sports reporting, sports journalism as a whole. I think that's an interesting topic and something we should think through a bit. So more on this here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. As ever, we take one big topic and we talk about it all night. And tonight, that topic is sports betting. It's a topic on a lot of people's minds. Lots of states are having that conversation. So we're joined now by Adam Candy, who's managing editor at Legal Sports Report. When before the break, we were talking about this topic a bit and kind of beginning to unpack it a little bit. There's so much here, Adam. I wish we could have you on for hours because so much information there at LegalSportsReport.com. But I want to take a look now and shift a little bit bit about what do you think it will mean to sports journalism if on a federal level, if state by state, most states end up legalizing sports betting, might that shift the way that we think about covering sports?
I think there's no question. It has already begun. If you look at the news just from this week, a major deal was announced between Fox Sports and the Stars Group, which is a poker and sports betting operator. Fox purchased a stake in the Stars Group of nearly $250 million, and Fox Sports itself is going to launch a betting app. So we're going to see a merge here from a company that holds some of the biggest broadcast rights in all professional sports and the gambling industry. They're going to jump in with both feet with an app called Fox Bet. I think when you see things like that happening, you realize that not only is this going to be something where there are probably journalists dedicated to covering, you know, who do you bet on and, you know, what teams are our best favorites and so on like that, you're going to see where there's a financial interest in it for some of the larger players and media as well. I think what you're ultimately going to see is that as more states legalize, this becomes something that enters into the casual discussion a lot more easily than it has in the past. You know, in the days of Jimmy the Greek and some of the, you know, sort of, I don't want to say seedier characters, but they were certainly viewed that way when it came to sports betting in the mainstream. You had to speak in code. Brent Musburger, who started the VSiN network, someone who used to work gambling references into the broadcast in sort of covert ways, and now it's something that can be discussed a bit more openly.
Right. And then I think another issue, you know, when we're thinking about like how that will play out in newsrooms in particular, where ethics are discussed so often, I think another issue that perhaps is not included too much in the broader public conversation about this topic, and this is anecdotally me kind of pontificating here, but I feel like a lot of people are not super clear on how the leagues play into this, and that leagues, you know, look to get their cut of this, and you know, everybody wants a piece of this pie. But I think the part of where leagues step in, it gets really murky, and I feel like there's a lot of misconception around that.
I agree wholeheartedly. You know, when it comes to covering it from a news perspective, it's important to remember the history here, that when we talk about PASPA, the ban, that was a ban that had stood for better than 25 years. And when New Jersey ultimately challenged that ban and was successful at the Supreme Court level, it's important to remember who was opposing them. Every major professional sports league came out against the legalization of sports betting. They were all involved in that case. I mean, it began as Governor Christie versus the NCAA, but the other four professional sports leagues jumped in and sounded alarm bells and said, this will be terrible for professional sports. We can't protect the integrity. It's going to give people questions about the outcomes of games. And as soon as this happened last year, those tunes changed to very different songs, and the leagues began to try to find a way to get a cut. So what's happening right now, to give people an understanding, is that as states are looking at legalizing sports betting, Major League Baseball and the NBA in particular have lobbyists, and they have staff as well, going to every state, and they started trying to get something that they were calling an integrity fee, essentially saying that they were to get 1% of the total amount bet as an integrity fee. They needed this money, in their view, in order to protect the integrity of the games. Those who were opposed to that said, well, you know, there's been legal sports betting in Nevada for many, many years, and you haven't had any need for this money to protect your games this far, so why would you need that money now? So that, if you, to understand that 1% of all bets placed in the sports betting industry, that equates to about 20% of profit. So that is an enormous ask, even though it sounds like just 1%. You have to understand that sports betting is a business that operates on, at best, about a 5% margin at all times. So to understand where the leagues are coming from right now, they're going to try to find a way to get that money one way or the other. Currently, they're doing it in a way where they're trying to sell a product, and they're calling it official data. And they're saying to the sports book, if you want our official statistical feed that you can use to settle your bets, then you're going to have to pay us a certain amount in order to get that. And there are, I can get way into the weeds on this, but I'll avoid it. There are various sources to get that data. You don't have to go through the leagues, and for many, many years, there are data providers who have offered those statistics to sports books without any involvement from the league. So what you have right now is the leagues trying to find a way to get involved in this one way or the other to get some amount of the profit. Where they have had success is in striking some private deals with certain operators. MGM Resorts, one of the largest casino companies in the country, has now made deals with the NBA, with Major League Baseball, and with the NHL. The NFL has a deal with Caesars Entertainment. And these deals include those official data feeds, but they also include a much larger marketing arrangement where MGM Resorts can now use the logos of those leagues that they have partnered with and try to get market share quickly in this emerging market by saying, hey, we're the official partner of the NBA. Now, they're not exclusive partnerships, but MGM has certainly gone all in here in the early going with the leagues, and the leagues are getting some profit through those private deals.
Right. And so I wish we had so much more time to talk with you, but in the short time that we have left, in as much reporting as you've done on this topic of sports wagering, what has been the most surprising or most misunderstood thing that you have uncovered?
Wow. I think the simple answer to that is the amount of, I don't want to say misinformation, there's definitely a lack of information among those who are involved in making these decisions about whether or not states will have sports betting. I mean, I listen to more legislative hearings than I could possibly capture here in the time we have left. And in those hearings, you hear legislators talking about this business, and really, there are a lot of them who have no idea how it operates, who have no idea what is a reasonable tax structure and licensing fee, and they have this idea that sports gambling is sort of still done in the shadows. In the days that the Wire Act, which governs a lot of the interstate commerce when it comes to sports betting, was passed, we're talking about bookies and mafia and so on. It's such a different industry than that now. So in the end, I think what has surprised me is that there's a lack of information out there about just what sports betting is, how it operates, and so on. Among the public, I think the biggest misconception is that the striking down of PASPA made sports betting legal everywhere. Mm-hmm. Now, all it did was it made it so that your state can choose whether they want to legalize it.
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. I think there's been a lot of interesting legislative conversation and different spot, kind of different hang-ups that come up and different speed bumps in those conversations are kind of like, well, but what about this? Yes, but think about this. I think that's a really interesting point that you bring up. Well, I appreciate you being with us, Adam Candy, Managing Editor for Legal Sports Report. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. We've been talking about gambling tonight. Pretty specifically, we've been talking about the legalization of sports betting, which has been a really interesting topic, but I want to shift a little bit right now. So state lotteries, it's about a $75 billion industry that generates profits through, the misfortune of its participants, right? Because all this advertising kind of promises these big wins and all this big stuff and makes it look like this escape from our financial woes, right? Well, we're joined now by Matthew Curtis, who is the founder of Vice Lotteries, which is a company who literally wants to change the game when it comes to lotteries and games of chance. And a really, really interesting way, because I think it really reframes the conversation and the way we think about this topic. Matthew, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Hey, Amy. Thanks so much for having me on.
So talk about Vice Lotteries and explain to us what this approach is, because it's really very, very interesting. And reading the website looks like you've kind of flipped the whole idea on its head a bit.
Yeah. And so I think that what you guys have been talking about all show a lot is how the internet has changed consumer behavior and how it has changed the means of communication between individuals who are taking bets and individuals who are making bets. And one of the things that that really allows for is to eliminate the transaction cost, right? So when all we had was you could go to your local store and buy your local numbers, or when you could buy just your local scratch-offs, there was transaction cost involved in buying lottery tickets, and therefore someone had to lose money. With the internet, though, there doesn't have to be transaction cost. And so because betting is a zero-sum game, in order to make it good for the consumers to play, you just have to return all of the prize pool back to the winners. It is a very simple solution to a major problem in our country is that lots of people who see this as a way to get out of poverty, spend over and over again to buy their ticket that's going to win them a house or, you know, just a relief from their bills. And but they're losing 50 cents on the dollar right now. So we are in litigation with several states to be able to compete with the state lotteries to return all of the money back to the people so that they can essentially use lotteries as a savings account over time.
Which sounds like a really enormous undertaking. So as you're going state by state, what is the plan for rollout there? Is there a particular state pattern you're looking at?
Yeah, so what we're looking at is for the legal challenges, there's a couple different ones we have. One of the interesting things is that most of the states are not actually operating their own lotteries. So in Illinois, Camelot Games operates for them. It's actually a part of the Canadian government that is running a monopoly lottery in the state of Illinois. So we look for those sort of things that sort of tell a funny narrative, right? So like IGT in Indiana is operating there. They are a British company who makes about $165 million a year, or they take in $165 million a year. And, you know, Hoosiers lose at least $2 for every $1 that the state takes in, and that's before taxes. So we look for, you know, when you think about bringing a case to judges, this is a hard uphill battle for the law. You know, the states obviously generally have the right to regulate. Our basic argument is that they're not regulating; they're just looking for profit. In their search of profit, they've abandoned any sort of consumer protection that we would generally give them. You know, the police power to regulate. We're a startup in terms of a business and a start in terms of approaching the law. So, you know, we're going out there and filing and hearing back what we hear from the court and getting better. So, and we have 47 states to go do this in. So, and we really just need to get in one. I think that once consumers, you know, consumers are intelligent people. I think that, you know, when we think of lotteries, we think of them as unintelligent because they do lose all this money. But given another alternative, I have very little doubt that they would choose to win more or lose less, however you want to frame that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's such an interesting idea because it really, even bigger, it really reframes this idea of the way we think about vice. And we kind of opened the show talking about this with history professor Kevin Kaufman about this idea that, you know, it's not okay unless we need money. And it's only okay. It becomes very classist very quickly. Like, it's only okay if it's done in gentlemanly ways, like horse racing or, you know, or with a card game in a country club, but no one else. And I think there's all these exceptions to it. And I feel like we're in a moment anyway, as we're having conversations on the state level about changing the way gambling is regulated, the way recreational marijuana is legalized or not. I think it seems like we're in a moment where we're kind of revisiting this idea of taboo and how we interact with it.
Yeah, and I think that we treat taboo as states, as gamblers do, right? So there's a great dissertation that was just published by Jonathan Cohen from Virginia, and he talks about how there's sort of this, gamblers have this magical thinking that I'm going to be the winner. And most people who gamble will tell you that they've won, even though that can't possibly be true. And states do the same thing when they are sort of gambling with these taboos, right? So when New Jersey first put in its lottery, which was the second one, but it was kind of the biggest push, and they went into scratch-offs, you know, they sold it to the people as this was going to eliminate state taxes. And then, you know, the history has gone that it's sort of narrowed down to these narrower and narrower scopes of how much money it's actually bringing in. And that's without even an assumption of how much it's cost in additional services and just poverty and just, you know, for a lot of people, the most cogent interaction they have with their government is someone selling them a lottery ticket every day, right? And that has to affect your relationship with your government, that they're literally ripping you off. And that's how that's, you know, you're seeing the Illinois lottery that you're losing all this money to. It is a very odd way to interact with a large section of your society.
It's very interesting to think about it in these terms. So there is a case in New Hampshire that there's not a ton about it, but deeply in Google, it's out there, about a judge that this case has been put before this judge that has the potential to be very precedent setting. It's really dealing with state lotteries, the Wire Act, and how these transactions that you were describing run by other companies, sometimes foreign companies, are potentially violating the law when it comes to lotteries. Explain that, if you would, because I think that's a really interesting case that probably would start to shift some attitudes a little bit around this topic.
Yeah, and I think it's I would frame it as it's the conversation has already shifted, and now they're interpreting the law in a different way. So in the early 2000s, during the Bush administration, and you talked about this in this time narrative before, is that most people are against gambling. Expanding it online was a no-no. Then early during the Obama administration, I guess in 2011, there was a ruling by the Attorney General which said that the Wire Act only applied to sports gambling and it didn't apply to lotteries. What this meant is that for states who wanted to, is that they could open up the lottery and they could put it online. I think that six or seven states have done that thus far, Michigan being one of them. Their revenues are growing astronomically year over year. And so that happened. Attorney General Barr recently published a proposed interpretation of the rule, which stated that no, and this happens all the time in interpretation of laws, they reversed the Obama era administration and said the Wire Act does apply, and it is a real question of law of whether it does or not. As the judge has said, this is a terrible written law, and I think it was a law that was written that everyone, you know, they were against the mafia, so it was going to be broadly interpreted. So the question, which has come up subsequent to that, is not only is online gambling legal or illegal that the states are operating, the second question is, well, all of the data transfers over the wires for every type of gambling. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's scratch-offs or whether it's pick threes. Like, cloud services have taken over the world, and cloud services don't exist in every state. And they certainly aren't siloed the way that they would need to be. So from my understanding, all of the states are operating in violation of the Wire Act, which I think would put them in violation of RICO, which would be very interesting. And so the states are obviously very worried about this. They've filed tons of amicus briefs, and a lot of the companies, IGT, Scientific Games, has also filed amicus briefs. And at a district court level, that's very, very unusual. Typically, you see amicus briefs later on. But this is a big deal. This is an $80 billion industry for them.
It's really fascinating. There's so much to this. And I think with so many topics that we address on this show, and this one is no exception, it seems very straightforward. And as we begin to dig into it, there are social issues and legal issues and so many other things, many, many tentacles to this that I think are really fascinating. We're talking with Matthew Curtis, founder of Vice Lotteries. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. We've been talking about gambling. It brings up a lot of topics. We are joined right now by Matthew Curtis, founder of Vice Lotteries. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about some interesting case law, which it's a tangent I love to indulge because I really should have gone to law school because I love talking about case law and thinking about it and looking at it. I think it's such a fascinating topic. So, but back to Vice Lotteries a bit. When you first came up with this idea, was it in its current form, or did it take a few evolutions through the business?
Yeah, so at first I actually wanted ways for people to get involved in buying stocks, and so I sort of thought of it as, you know, how do you gamify people into buying a mutual fund essentially? So I thought of it as like, okay, we'll just, you know, people love to bet, right? So we'll just make it bet, and they will just get a random distribution of stocks that will just make a mutual fund. And, you know, it would take some time, but essentially you would just be buying the fund that you should have bought, but you're doing it in a fun way that gets people involved in buying more stocks and bonds. There's way more legal gray area than that, and I think I came back to, like, okay, if we can't do this, like, this is a, you know, right now individuals are losing 50% of their dollar every time they bet. Let's solve that problem first before we worried about, you know, the 5 or 6% they could make on the stock market. So yeah, it started there, and then it, you know, you always start with your problem first. This is a massive problem, and looking for a solution, it's relatively simple, right? You build the app, you install PayPal, and you start taking bets. Unfortunately, there's like jail that comes on after that if you don't think through it a little more in depth. So I actually went to law school to, you know, understand how this area of constitutional law works, which is most of the claims are in economic liberty, which falls under the due process and equal protection clause. And this is not an area of law that's well litigated. There's not very many people who you can ask and they even know anything about it. So that was my approach to it. It was also really interesting just to go to law school. So that's. You know, it's actually a very simple solution, and it's morphed now. You know, what we really want to do is we want to provide the back end and the infrastructure that our end users can trust, but we want to build out what's called APIs, and so this is the way most applications are built, that one person will provide data and another person will kind of provide the front and the UI. So we really want to be the back end that's providing the, you know, the payments and the security and just making sure the games are equitable and do return all the money for as much of the industry as we can. So that's sort of how it is, you know, because there's so much, you know, this is an $80 billion industry that's larger than the entire entertainment industry, you know, that's larger than sports. And lottery should be like creative and fun. And, you know, this is how people are spending their time in their life, and like it should be way better than just a scratch off. Mm-hmm. Not only should they not be losing, but they should get some more enjoyment out of it.
And in looking through your website and learning more about your company, I mean, it seems like there is taking out some of the pieces of the equation. It seems like what you'll be left with is a place where you'll gain financial literacy, but then also stand to lose much less, even if you're not winning.
Correct. So we set limits on how much people can bet, and so basically we take the frequency of their play times the amount that they're betting, and we just make sure that over a year period they'll make back what they put in. Right. So if you're playing the pick three, we'll just make sure the distribution ends up that you're going to come out the same end. And one other thing that we were, you know, talking about was addiction, right? So we can solve the financial problem, but we won't be able to solve the addiction problem that with the same way, right? So addiction is different than just losing money, and although losing money is a really bad consequence of this addiction right now, but we're working with a company called Boundless.ai, and they came from Twitter. And what they do is they track users and actually kick them off when they're going into addictive cycles. Obviously, this won't be like perfect from the start, but it's a really great way, you know, that we can at least start to look at user behavior and say, okay, this person went from using their app only at home, and now they're doing it while they're driving, and they're doing it at work. And so we can say, we're just going to almost like throttle their experience just to make them to leave, which is really something that, like, while the lotteries are doing online, I encourage them to reach out to Boundless, because I think that it's something that should go into every app that's doing gambling, no matter what.
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting point, right? Because the way that most state lotteries are structured, it's like, you know, play responsibly. But if you don't, that's on you. That's up to you to figure it out.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's one of the great things about technology. You know, technology gets sometimes vilified incorrectly for all the tracking. But when you're thinking about addiction, using that tracking data, not to sell it to advertisers, but to use it to say, okay, you're going through, you know, I have something that I'm selling that is addicting. When I can see you being more addicted, I'm going to stop you from being addicted. Like, I'm going to slow this down and make this a little annoying so you leave. And you know, that's what's, you know, that's a preventative means of stopping addiction. And there's no way that won't work 100% of the time. But I think it's more effective than just saying, you know, play responsibly or whatever the tagline is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. So as you have been approaching courts and beginning to, you know, this process of trying to make this work in a bunch of different states, what have the biggest hurdles been? What has the feedback been like?
So I think the biggest hurdle for me, and this is partially my fault, is that I just think that everyone should get it right away. Like most entrepreneurs, this solution is clear and simple to me. But the path of understanding is much longer, right? And so one of our biggest things is that we just have to educate that there is another way to do this. And I think people have so many blinders about gambling, you know, correctly, right? So, you know, so many people have had family members who have lost a lot. So many, you know, it affects everyone's life, and everyone has to take a definite position on it. So kind of figuring out how to crack through that definite position and say, like, hey, there's actually a better way to do this. And for the people who are gambling, like, I'm not telling them that what they've been doing has been wrong all their lives. I'm just saying that if you had a better option, you would probably want to take it. But that took some time for us to learn how to talk about it even. Because, you know, at first we started talking about, like, oh, people are losing money. You know, they shouldn't be losing money. This just wasn't effective.
It's very, very interesting. So people can head to vicelotteries.com for more, to learn more about it, to explore the site. It's all very interesting. Appreciate you joining us. Matthew Curtis, founder of Vice Lotteries. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, and then turn things over to Dave Hoekstra. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. That does it for us this week on the Saturday Night Special. We'll see you next time. Special thanks to producer Vivian Lanoux.
Had a great time.
I'm glad you were here.
I'm glad I'm here too, Amy.